Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
A big change in Mexico. Voters will go to the polls Sunday to elect judges at all levels of the judiciary.
Las encuestadoras serias lo que han encontrado es que...
Pollsters say that voters don't really know the candidates. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. More on Mexico's historic judicial election, plus a diplomat's take on the current Israeli-led effort to get aid into Gaza.
It's not practical to meet the needs of a desperate population.
Then, when disaster strikes, reacting to it will only get you so far. Preparing ahead of time gives you an edge.
This shelf here is for all the pasta, he tells me. This other is for canned goods. This basket has everything for lighting and for starting fires.
How one community of Spanish preppers is taking it to the next level.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for being with us today. Mexico is heading into an historic election. This weekend, voters will select judges at all levels, from local courts all the way up to the highest court in the land.
The process will amount to a complete reshaping of the judicial branch of government. It's coming off of a controversial reform policy implemented late last year. In the past, judges were appointed, not elected by popular vote. The World's Tibi Saizea in Mexico City has been taking the political temperature in the run-up to this election.
In the streets of Mexico City, few voters seem to know who's on the ballot in this Sunday's judicial election.
Estamos enterados que va a haber unas votaciones, pero no sabemos quién son los candidatos ni nada.
We know there will be an election, but we don't know anything about the candidate, says a taxi driver. Others say people still need to understand what a judge or a magistrate does.
¿Qué hace un juez? ¿Y de qué me sirve a mí como persona?
Or how they serve the public. The confusion is understandable. Thousands of candidates are competing for over 2,500 positions, from district courts all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Las encuestadoras serias lo que han encontrado es que nadie los conoce realmente, ni siquiera.
What serious pollsters are finding is that no one really knows the candidates, not even the Supreme Court justices, says Miguel Mesa, a lawyer with the group Defensores, who is educating people about this election. Candidates are banned from traditional campaign activities. They can't buy ads, receive party endorsements, or participate in debates. So it is harder for voters to know who they are.
Entonces lo que sucede es que las personas votan de manera aleatoria.
Mesa says people could end up voting for random candidates or not vote at all. Few democracies in the world elect judges, and that's because research shows judges are less likely to uphold the law when doing so is unpopular. But advocates of Mexico's reform have long argued that the justice system here is broken. Nearly 94% of crimes committed in Mexico are either not reported or not investigated, according to Mexico's National Institute of Statistics.
¿Por qué surge la reforma al Poder Judicial? Pues porque el Poder Judicial está mal.
President Claudia Sheinbaum says the election of judges will purge corruption and improve access to justice. This judicial reform was rushed into law in September of last year, one of the final achievements of former President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Mexicans will be electing judges in about half of its states now, and the rest will be up for election in 2027. In total, more than 7,000 judges and magistrates will have to resign and stand for election. And of course, those now presiding over Mexico's courts aren't happy about doing this. Last September, protests led by lawyers and judges shut down the entire judicial system for weeks. Carla Luisa Sanchez, a federal judge near Mexico City, was among those demanding the reform not pass.
Considero que la reforma acabó con años de carrera judicial de muchas personas.
She says the reform put an end to years of judicial careers for many people and risks turning the judiciary into a popularity contest. Sanchez was ready to comply with a resignation mandate and leave the public sector. But when she saw the list of candidates competing for her position, she decided to run.
Me preocupa dejar el lugar a una persona que esté muchísimo menos preparada que yo.
I worry about leaving my seat to someone who's not as prepared as I am, Sanchez says. To qualify, candidates need only a law degree, 5 years of legal experience, and 5 letters of recommendation. Sanchez is among a minority of sitting judges who are standing for election, and her story reflects a broader anxiety about who's seeking power in the courts, says activist Miguel Mesa.
Claro, nosotros convocamos a los ciudadanos a vigilar la elección.
His group is calling on citizens to warn about suspicious candidacies for this judicial election. After reviewing hundreds of candidates, he says at least 18 raise serious concerns.
Candidatos altamente riesgosos. 8 de ellos están relacionados con el crimen organizado.
He's found 8 people with ties to organized crime, including a former lawyer for Joaquín El Chapo Guzmán, the cartel boss imprisoned in the U.S. And several other candidates are backed by an evangelical church whose leaders are facing charges for child abuse. While defending a high-profile criminal isn't illegal, Mesa says these candidacies raise ethical questions and reflect how lax the vetting process has been.
El principal riesgo es que se vendan, pues, a sus clientes o a sus jefes en
Mesa
algunos
worries
casos.
That organized crime could now be looking to buy judges. When confronted, authorities said they will investigate judges elected and could nullify some of them after the election. This Sunday, Mexico will become the only country in the world where every judge, local and federal, is elected by popular vote. For the World, I'm Tibi Saizea, Mexico City.
After a 3-month blockade that prevented much-needed food from entering Gaza, Israel began allowing aid trucks into the territory last week. But the situation has been chaotic. Today, hundreds of Palestinians stormed a United Nations food warehouse. 4 people died, according to hospital officials, and on Tuesday, crowds of hungry people overwhelmed another new aid distribution site, and security forces opened fire, killing at least 1 person and injuring 48 others. That's according to the Associated Press.
The distribution site is part of a new effort called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. It was created by the U.S. and Israel, but it's not been an encouraging start for the organization, whose chief resigned on the eve of its rollout. He said it didn't adhere to humanitarian principles of neutrality. Ambassador David Satterfield was special envoy for Middle East humanitarian issues under the Biden administration. We spoke earlier today, and Satterfield explained what humanitarian neutrality is supposed to mean when it comes to food aid.
The principles in play here are pretty basic. It is one of neutrality and delivery of assistance to all in need where they may be or wherever they may be. If aid is channeled only to a select number of sites, to a select number of days of access, but you must come to these sites, most of which, as I understand it, are many kilometers away, that isn't consistent with humanitarian principles, and I would note it's not practical to meet the needs of a desperate population. No assistance has gone to the north of Gaza. In late April, early May of last year, just prior to the initiation of the Rafah operation, they were moving to some 400 distribution sites in north, central, and southern Gaza. They were, by that point, meeting the basic feeding needs of all of Gaza's population. Now, when I say meeting basic feeding needs, I'll be quite blunt. We were able to prevent famine, to prevent starvation from emerging. Because the aid was flowing at a very significant rate, 400 to 500 trucks a day, more on occasion, we had demonetized the assistance.
Demonetizing the aid. Does that suggest that by reducing so much the amount of aid that goes into Gaza, you're actually making it more valuable for a group like Hamas to acquire and then perhaps like sell on the black market?
There is no doubt that when only limited volumes of assistance move in, you incentivize criminal and other activities to take the aid because of the high value it presents on the marketplace. But a comment here with respect to Hamas. Hamas could end the suffering of the Palestinian people of Gaza tonight, within hours, were it to abandon its own quest for its own ideological and political reasons for victory in Gaza, victory through attrition, attrition of Israel, attrition of the international community. They started this. They are responsible for the misery of the Palestinians, and that should never be ignored or blurred in any discussion of this issue. They hold living hostages. They hold the bodies of dead hostages. They and they alone are responsible for this. That said, Israel has a responsibility under international humanitarian law and practice to assure that the basic needs of the civilian population of Gaza are met. And that's a responsibility which, since the cessation of aid on March 2nd, has been a major, major issue for Israel, for the IDF. They know they have to address it. The manner in which they address it matters. And this experiment in running distribution sites while a massive kinetic campaign goes on, if that can work, wonderful. But it hasn't been demonstrated yet to be successful.
Is it clear how much aid is being diverted by Hamas, or how much was when more aid was flowing into Gaza?
I can speak to my personal experience during the time that I was presidential envoy.
Please.
There was never, at no time, any assertion made to me while I was envoy of significant Hamas diversion of humanitarian assistance. Hamas undoubtedly derived significant political benefit from its presence, its physical presence at distribution sites. Hamas was able to show to the civilian population, here we are. You're a friend of ours. Here's where you go in the line. You're not a friend. Here's where you go in the line. No question.
So they may have been controlling access to the aid.
The manner in which distribution was done was, I think, without question, managed in a fashion that allowed Hamas to at least optically show their presence. But when I speak of diversion of aid, let me be clear, because there's confusion on this point. UN purchased UN and international NGOs, Save the Children, Catholic Relief, Mercy Corps, the big international NGOs, World Food Program for the UN family, their assistance efforts were carefully monitored. And the aid they delivered, they distributed, was accountable. The aid that came in through other channels, and there were numerous other channels, including from Egypt through the Egyptian Red Crescent, other assistance that came in on a bilateral basis, that did not possess that accountability. At no time was the UN, was I, or the international assistance community able to make an accounting for where that assistance went. And the Israeli government was well aware of this fact. No concealment, no question. Did Hamas divert that assistance in part? I can't say. It's quite possible. But with respect to UN and international assistance, true diversion, seizure, was minimal. It was not significant, and nor was it ever asserted privately by Israel to be the case. If you wish to succeed in establishing a Gaza which is anything other than a source of misery, despair, and radicalism. You need to address humanitarian issues as you address the military and terrorist threat that Hamas poses.
Ambassador David Satterfield served as special envoy for Middle East humanitarian issues during the Biden administration.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It is hot out there and only getting hotter. The World Meteorological Organization has released a new forecast for the next 5 years and finds new heat records are likely to be set. Alice Alpert is a climate scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund. She says these predictions serve an important role.
Reports like this are an essential gauge to estimate what trajectory we're on as in terms of warming. So what impacts to plan for, and on what time frame, which is really essential.
And what trajectory does this report say that we are on?
So it's likely that the average temperature will be above 1.5 degrees for 1 year at some point before 2030. It's also likely that the five-year mean will be above 1.5.
And there's also a tiny, tiny chance that we might see that 2-degree threshold exceeded in the near future. A very small chance, but I understand
very
that
small.
Is also seen as significant by scientists.
Yeah, but I think the main takeaway is that every bit matters. Regardless of whether we're below 1.5 or above 1.5, we're seeing impacts.
So what are the consequences of the level of heat that we're talking about in this forecast? What kind of world does that look like?
We can definitely expect more of what we're seeing now, which is more wildfires, more extreme precipitation events, more droughts, more variability in the amount of rain, and more compound events, which is where you have more than one hazard happening at the same time. So a great example of that, or tragic, would be a drought, so less rain, and more heat. That stresses crops a lot more, and that can lead to changes in agricultural yields more.
Mm-hmm. I know that different parts of the world are heating up faster than others. The Arctic, for example, is called out in this report. Rainfall is also changing differently in different areas. What parts of the world are you most concerned about over the next few years?
So that raises a really important point about adaptation, which is that the impact that you feel, it has to do with the hazard, but also your ability to deal with it. So the areas of the world that I'm most concerned about are the ones where there are a lot of people who might be subsistence farmers who are very exposed to changes in their crop success.
Are there systemic barriers to adaptation that need to get more attention as we move into this ever-warming world?
Yeah. Adaptation finance has always lagged what we call mitigation or reducing emissions funds. The business models aren't as well developed because it's not so much like selling a new energy. But that's not to say that it doesn't have a return on investment when you don't have as much impacts from something that could be devastating.
This report is the latest in a long line of global scientific reports with a lot of distressing news. It's kind of scary if you're paying attention. What do you have? What kind of advice do you have for people who look at this and worry if, you know, it's too late to get a handle on climate change?
Clearly, we can't deny that climate change is happening and we can't bury our heads in the sand. But it's also not a reason to throw up our hands. It's not all or nothing. You can still save so much. There are actions that we can take to blunt the worst impacts of climate change. So that's why I am still continuing to work and I'm still optimistic.
Alice Alpert is a climate scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, describing a new five-year forecast from the World Meteorological Organization.
In Spain, the past few years have been good for people bracing for a bad future. I'm talking about preppers, the folks who stockpile everything from food to survival gear to be prepared for disasters. Spain's preppers are saying, "I told you so," a lot lately, pointing out how they've fared better than most, from pandemics to power outages. The world's Jerry Haddon met up with a prepper in Barcelona to learn more.
After a while, this sound might start to grate on some people. It sounds like some mechanical mosquito on a runaway merry-go-round. But for 40-year-old school teacher Guillaume Sayol, the winding noise equals peace and preparedness. He's making the sound by spinning the crank on a rechargeable flashlight. He's grabbed it out of a box in a small storage room under the basement stairs of his house. This shelf here is for all the pasta, he tells me. This other is for canned goods. This basket has everything for lighting and for starting fires. In the back, we've got more batteries, he says, plus gas for the camp stove. This is Sayol's main prepper stockpile, but there's more stuff stashed all over the house. Sayol says he wouldn't call his home a bunker, but it's definitely a good place to hunker down if all heck breaks loose.
Vamos mirando y al fin y al cabo tenemos para un mes más o menos.
We've got enough supplies in here to last us for a month, he says. Sayol and his family are part of a growing number of Spanish preppers. There are no firm numbers, but on Facebook, prepper groups have tens of thousands of members, on Telegram, nearly 5,000, and more people join every day. That's peanuts compared to the millions of preppers, say, in the U.S., but the Spanish movement's gaining traction, what with the COVID lockdown 5 years ago, then last year's floods near Valencia, where hundreds of thousands of people found themselves without food and water.
Red Eléctrica está trabajando ya con todas las operadoras para recuperar.
And then there was the national blackout just this April. For the 10 hours it lasted, people had to rely on battery-operated radios just to find out what was happening. The internet and cell phone service were down. Since then, online, survivalists have been quick to say things could have been much worse. And also, I told you so. If the blackout had dragged on into a second day, said a popular prepper named José Luis Presas on YouTube, we would have seen some really terrible things on the street, as in looting, perhaps violence. Sayol doesn't agree. He thinks calamity would unite neighbors, not divide them. But the I told you so part, yeah, he's been sort of enjoying it. Whenever I would mention prepping to colleagues, he says, they'd say I was taking things a bit too far. But after the blackout, they said, man, you were lucky. I need to be more prepared myself. How'd you do it? One friend, he says, told him he ate a can of tuna for lunch during the blackout because it was the only thing he had that didn't need to be cooked. Another didn't eat at all.
Bien. Comimos, tranquilos, teníamos de todo, hicimos una barbacoa.
Here at home, says Sayol, we were just fine. We cooked on the barbecue. It was like a little party, he says. We had our rechargeable lamps and candles going. This is the goal, it seems, for most Spanish preppers, just to have enough to tide you over until an emergency has passed. But they're often labeled as alarmists or worse. In one Telegram channel, a member blames the Americans for the bad rap and what he calls their obsession on big screen and small with the apocalypse.
By the time the sun comes up tomorrow, there's a very good chance you'll be dead.
You're gonna lose.
The HBO series The Last of Us features a lot of preppers. You know, it's that show about fungus zombies trying to infect the remaining healthy humans, cue the end of times. In the hands of those preppers are lots of guns, something unheard of here.
No tenemos ni armería, ni nada con esto.
We don't have a weapons cache, laughs Sayol, should the zombies show up at our door. We have a handsaw for cutting wood. Anyway, he says, real crises like blackouts require stocks of medicine, water, and food. You can't eat bullets, he says, while you're waiting for the lights to come back on. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Nigeria is dealing with a new wave of extremist violence carried out by a group that's been around for many years. Boko Haram is behind a string of attacks that have killed dozens of people in recent months. The group goes back to at least 2009, when its members vowed to fight Western influence and impose a radical version of Islamic law on Nigeria. Alchukwuma Okoli is a Nigerian security expert with the Federal University of Lafia. We spoke earlier today, and I asked him to explain what Boko Haram wants.
Boko Haram is a jihadi style insurgency. It's an organization that seeks to pursue the course of Islamization, particularly northwest Nigeria, by the principle of Sharia, Islamic law, precisely in that context.
And who are they targeting?
Of course, the prime target is the Nigerian state. It's an insurgency, it seeks to overthrow the government but of course, it also targets the Nigerian citizenry. People of all faith, but more predominantly the Christian populations have been particularly targeted in the context of the northeast and north central Nigeria.
Now, many of us will remember the Bring Back Our Girls campaign in 2014. Hundreds of girls at a boarding school in northern Nigeria, they were kidnapped by this kind of first iteration of Boko Haram. Now, Boko Haram is no longer just one single group. What do you know about these splinter groups operating in this part of Nigeria?
So today, we have a faction called Jazz, and we have another one that is sort of a franchise of ISIS. ISWAP is standing for Islamic State West Africa Province. So what we witness is a complication of violence orchestrated by disparate factions of insurgents and terrorist groups. And so what we're witnessing seems to be a resurgence of jihadi violence, jihadi militantism of a sort. And that has been associated with immense humanitarian crisis in northern Nigeria.
So what has the Nigerian government been doing in response to this resurgence of these groups?
Well, Nigerian government has been quite embattled. I mean, the state itself. What we have seen is this tendency to rely on what we call kinetic approach to counterinsurgency. Military approach is important, but that alone cannot address the challenge. We need to understand the gamut of factors that drive and catalyze terrorism. In contexts where you find prevalence of poverty, where you find prevalence of unemployment, okay? These are some economic conditions, including the existence of historical grievances, okay, that terrorists may exploit to mobilize the locals into their mission, you see. So the approach we are talking about is actually a kind of seeking to understand that these critical elements are important in the fight against terrorism. We need to address the factor of poverty, illiteracy, and of course, we need to also address some other factors like governance issues.
So you're basically talking about dealing with basic human needs so that terrorism is less attractive. What details can you share with us about how the violence has displaced people in northern Nigeria?
So it's really a dire case of emergency, and the populations have been displaced, communities have been displaced, and the IDP camps are saturated where they are actually in existence anyway. And some of them, a handful of them that exist, are lacking critical infrastructure to support effective living.
The extremists have attacked military camps, speaking of what the government is doing. So what does that tell you about the strength of Boko Haram right now and their determination?
The violence in question is asymmetric in nature. And so the logic of the violence, it actually departs from the conventional pattern of armed violence that you are used to. And it is the terrorist group that even wields some strategic advantage in that regard. So this is what we are dealing with.
Al-Chukwuma Al-Koli is a security expert in Nigeria. He spoke with us today from N'Djamena, the capital of Chad.
And now a few water cooler stories from the headlines.
Legendary soccer player Diego Maradona is still making news 5 years after his death. Seven healthcare workers are on trial in Buenos Aires. They're accused of providing inadequate care to the star athlete in his final days. And now one of the judges in the case is also under scrutiny. Prosecutors say Judge Julieta McIntosh allowed the filming of a documentary during the trial. Not only that, she is one of the lead characters in the movie. McIntosh recused herself yesterday at the request of the defendants. The other two judges will decide how the trial will proceed.
In Moscow this week, a forum of Russian lawmakers was going after Shrek. The Moscow Times reports that they criticized Western toys, Western films, and fictional characters like Shrek, saying they're harmful to Russian children. The lawmakers accused Western countries of indoctrinating Russian youth.
And in Gordons Bay, South Africa, people were fixated on something stranger than fiction, a 2-ton elephant seal lumbering through town. Locals filmed the animal while police tried to contain him. The seal can be seen resting his huge head on the hood of a car, climbing over another car, then crossing a road. When he got to a shopping mall, animal welfare officials intervened with a sedative and took the adventurous elephant seal back to the bay.
I hope he had fun. And that's a few things you might have missed. The civil war in Myanmar has dragged on for more than 4 years and killed an estimated 50,000 people. Myanmar's neighbors are growing impatient with the ongoing fighting. China and governments across Southeast Asia are getting more forceful about trying to broker peace. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
In diplomatic circles, it is considered mission impossible, getting Myanmar's military junta and all the armed groups that hate it to hash things out. But
I think it's time for them to talk.
That's Anwar Ibrahim, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, speaking this week to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, known as ASEAN. Malaysia currently chairs this bloc of countries. Its leaders have been quietly talking to Myanmar's military and the rebel factions trying to tear down the military once and for all.
The first serious attempt at engagement has happened, and we have to move beyond that now.
But this is much easier said than done. For many in the resistance, the idea of making nice with the military is seen as naive or even traitorous. This is a military that, for much of the country's history, has imposed totalitarian rule and persecuted minorities, even to the point of genocide, according to the UN. I asked one of those armed resistance groups if they're feeling more pressure from other Southeast Asian countries to talk things out.
Yeah, so we see that the pressure comes everywhere from every side.
That's Saw Ta Ni, a senior official with the Karen National Union, one of the most powerful guerrilla armies dug deep into Myanmar's mountains. He tells me, sure, we'll talk to the junta if they give up all political power and stand trial for their crimes.
This is our position. Whether they agree or not, so we don't care.
I also reached out to Myanmar's military, but got no reply. Countries such as Malaysia, Thailand, and others, they're trying to build on a tiny bit of momentum, a shaky ceasefire between the military and resistance groups that came about after a devastating earthquake 2 months ago today. That ceasefire is set to expire this weekend, and really, it's not been perfectly stable. A group of young men in T-shirts blasting a 50-caliber machine gun in Myanmar's Mandalay region. They're trying to hit a tiny black speck in a big blue sky. It's a military helicopter. They posted this clip online. And this is just one of dozens and dozens and dozens of feisty new armed cells that have sprung up in recent years. They answer to no single commander.
In the Myanmar's context, there's no leader in the opposition.
Professor Inze Han is with the University of Hong Kong.
So I think it would be very hard to have this kind of dialogue.
Much harder, he says, than peace talks between Ukraine and Russia, because at least they have two cohesive sides. Myanmar's resistance groups are wildly diverse, some big, some tiny, some friendly with China, some pro-democracy. Some use cheap exploding drones and others wield surface-to-air missiles. Their stance on compromise can differ too.
I think some probably are more willing to have a dialogue with the military than the others.
Especially the armed groups who look up to China. Han says it's really China that has the heft to maybe kickstart serious peace talks in Myanmar, and they've been trying. He suspects Beijing, behind the scenes, has been prodding Southeast Asian leaders to step up their recent peace talk efforts. China can get some resistance factions to the table, Han says. Probably not all, but it can at least pressure the military junta to show up and talk.
The military government right now is probably one of the weakest in recent history. So that means it's much more desperate to seek support.
Support from China, Malaysia, Thailand, anyone. Saw Ta Ni from the Karen National Union, that battle-hardened guerrilla army in the hills. He has some advice for his enemies, the generals leading the military junta. Repent.
It is a good opportunity for the junta to change.
Relinquish the fight, he says. That will bring on the peace talks that all of Asia wants to see. The military, of course, will say the very same thing back to the resistance. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Even if you never bought a Putumayo music compilation, you no doubt saw them. Sometimes in unusual places for music sales, a coffee shop, a museum bookshop, the gift shop at a zoo, or the Putumayo listening station in the middle of Whole Foods. You'd instantly recognize the playful and colorful artwork on the covers. When brick-and-mortar music stores began closing, Putumayo CD sales kept pace. The music in the collections, like From Cairo to Casablanca, was fresh. Dan Storper was the irrepressible music fan, determined to get people listening to some of the amazing sounds he discovered while he was alive. We learned of Dan's passing last week at his home in New Orleans. It was how he thought about spreading the gospel of global music outside the usual pathways we find music that made Dan unique. He wanted us to open our ears and use all the tools at his disposal to make that happen.
We're delighted that this is taking place here tonight. Our next guest, one of Zimbabwe's most celebrated and popular singers, his wonderful new CD is called Vunza Moto. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Oliver Mutukutsi.
Oliver Mutukutsi's appearance on national TV in 2002. That was Dan Storper working his connections at The Late Show on CBS. Dan Storper's introduction to music from around the world actually began with a trip he made. After majoring in Latin American studies in college, simple curiosity took him to the Putumayo region of Colombia. He told me about that in a 2013 interview we featured on the show.
So I followed the map, and I went to this little village called Sibundoy in the Putumayo region, and really was struck by the beauty, the people, indigenous people. Actually, I was there on Carnival Day, and they were celebrating Carnival dressed in very beautiful costumes and really happy. And you looked out, and there was this beautiful mountainside of the Andes with the birds chirping and a little stream flowing into the Putumayo River Valley. You know, it was part of the valley. I just felt like it was a magic moment. Everything's right with the world.
That visit led Storper creating, in New York City in 1975, the first of several Putumayo shops selling crafts from Colombia. There are any number of stories of well-meaning Westerners who want to share what they find exciting in other parts of the world. Storper actually turned the name Putumayo into a brand, and when that turns into a pop culture punchline, as it did in one Seinfeld episode, there's a risk that the culture itself gets short shrift.
Together, we can drive Putumayo out of business and make Cinco de Mayo numero uno.
It's not the kind of attention that typically would drift back to the indigenous people in the Putumayo region, and that's probably a good thing. What was understood back in Colombia was that Storper's approach to business was driven out of a respect for the culture. He discovered that by accident himself a few years ago when he returned there as a VIP, flying down in the company of then-president Alvaro Uribe.
Two-day journey, went down to the Putumayo region where he was having a town hall meeting with local village chiefs and mayors, et cetera, talking about problems in the community. When this woman stood up and said, you know, you visited my village, Sibundoy, when I was about 4 years old and bought handicrafts from my father, who was the mayor of the village. And he talked about how Putumayo had spread the word, positive message of the Putumayo, despite all the issues of drugs and all, you know, the FARC and all the issues with guerrilla warfare. And we've talked about it over the years. My dad died a few years ago, but I will always remember this. And I stood there, like tears streaming down my face and thinking about the fact that, you know, it's not just about the handicrafts, but the music, and that somehow the impact that was made over the years to kind of present the more positive side of what is always a struggle in a lot of the world, both with the clothing and handicrafts business of Putumayo and also now with the music label.
A precious legacy that will stand the test of time. Dan Storper was 74.
There is a whole spectrum of human behavior that can be observed at the end of a long flight. There are the applauders. There are the lingerers, those who take their sweet time to pack up their stuff. They can usually be found in the middle seat when you are at the window.
And then there are the flyers who treat deplaning like an Olympic sport. Those for whom this announcement...
I will turn off the seatbelt sign once we park at the gate. Until that time, please remain seated.
Has no meaning. There is even a term for these people these days, aisle lice.
Aisle lice.
That's a horrible name.
It's a horrible name, but don't you just feel all, you're just like,
it's
really?
Horrible behavior.
Like, where are you going?
As of the beginning of May, these eager beavers have had to endure more than the nasty glances and judgy of fellow passengers, at least in Turkey.
Aviation officials there announced there will be fines for people who stand up early. Under new regulations, it is verboten to unbuckle seatbelts, open overhead bins, or crowd aisles until after the airplane has come to a full stop. It is not clear how much the fine will be, but Turkish media has reported it could be as much as $70. For some people, I'm sure it will still be worth it.
No word yet on how much they'll charge that guy who steals the armrest, but it won't be enough.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The president of Namibia today inaugurated a new and solemn national holiday. Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah announced a remembrance day for the victims of what's known as the 20th century's first genocide. That's when German colonizers murdered more than 70,000 Africans.
Finally, we have a day in the year that unites us as a nation to remember the victims of the 1904-1908 genocide.
Those victims came from the Ova, Herero, and Nama communities. Descendants of the victims have been fighting for recognition and for reparations for years. Jefta Guherimo is one of them. He's a Namibian of Herero descent and heads up the Ova, Herero People's Memorial and Reconstruction Foundation. He says today's official commemoration of the genocide was historic.
It is very important because it's the first time that the genocide is being given a public recognition within Namibia. For years, we have been fighting to get a national holiday in commemoration or in remembrance of this painful chapter in the history of Namibia and Namibians.
So it's an important day of recognition. I understand, though, as you've mentioned, I think that there's also been a fight for reparations and for land return. Can you tell me about that?
Of course, when the German committed crimes against the Herero and Nama, they not only committed the crimes, but they also took away the land that belonged to them, including their property, cattle, and all animals. And so they were dispossessed of their land and they were systematically killed. And so the fight for reparation, first acknowledgement from Germany and then apology and reparation, it means that we want our ancestral land back that was taken. And today still the German Namibians are still occupying our land. So this is struggle for reparation is to make us to restore and repair the community that were harmed by the genocide.
So this all was happening in the early 1900s when Germany was colonizing what was then called Southwest Africa. Why were these two communities a target during that time?
Simply because they were the first contact with the German settlers, the Germans who came to Namibia, and they occupied the fertile farmland that were conducive for agriculture and other activities. So it was a struggle about land, and also Germany wanted to make space for German settlers. So the only way they have to do is to get rid of the Hereros and Nama who were living in those areas. And so that's how they started.
there's kind of an eerie piece of history here, similar to the Holocaust, in that Germans in Namibia used concentration camps. Can you tell me what happened in those camps?
Yes, and after the defeat of the Herero and Nama people, basically the Germans rounded up all the remaining Hereros and put them in concentration camps. And the intent was to use them as a free labor to work on the construction of railroads between 1905 to 1908. That was the whole idea of the concentration camp. But then things turned worse in the sense that the German scientists also wanted to do some medical experiments on the Herero and Nama people in the concentration camp. So this is where some of the German scientists went to the southern part of Namibia, where there was a big concentration camp. And basically what they did is systematically kill some people intentionally, and they would cut off their head, and they were sent to Berlin for scientific experiments. And so this is still ongoing struggle. And a few years ago, some of those skulls were returned to Namibia, and hundreds or more are remaining in Germany.
Hundreds more.
Yeah, so the question of the concentration camps, it was work camps and death camps, as well as just for sexual gratification of German settlers. And so as a result, you see a lot of, probably 10% of Herero are light-skinned people as a result of rapes that occurred during the concentration camps.
Mm. And the scientific experimentation you mentioned is also sounds like a precursor to what happened to Jews during the Holocaust.
Of course, because Jürgen Fischer, the head of that racial classification of people, he did his first experiment in Namibia. And he went back and, of course, carried the work against the Jewish people in Germany. So there is a parallel and historical connection about these two atrocities, even though dissimilar in many respects.
You've outlined such terrible atrocities that happened to the Ova Herero and Nama people. What is the legacy of what happened in these communities today?
The legacy is basically intergenerational poverty as a result of landlessness. Their land was taken away. And then the intergenerational trauma that is ongoing. 80%, they say, of the Herero were killed and 50% of the Nama people were killed.
80% and 50% of those two communities?
Yes. And so as a result, their participation in the democratic process is very minimal. And so the communities that were not affected, that are politically dominant in the country, they enjoy that majority status. And so the issue of reparation and demand for genocide remembrance has taken so long because the other communities do not feel the affinity with this community in terms of the genocide.
Can you tell me where that call stands? I know that there are still negotiations ongoing between the Namibian government and the German government for an apology and reparations, right?
Yeah, the German government basically, yes, I can say they have apologized publicly, but they said that we are going to come to Namibia to apologize. They haven't done that. We're waiting for that. At the same time, they offered to pay $1.1 billion over a 30-year period, and I think they reduced it to 23 now, to the communities that were affected by the genocide. But this money will not go directly to the community. It will be given to the government to construct roads and clinic. And so as a result, the community that were affected by the genocide publicly rejected that because now the German was a committed genocide, and now they're also dictating the terms as to how that money should go about and what project. So the community want to determine their own destiny as how to restore their community and how to restore their ancestral land.
You live in the U.S., but I know you go back to Namibia frequently. Is there land that you know used to belong to your family?
Of course, I know the land, specifically the farm that where my ancestors were chased from during the genocide, and it's still in the hands of I think they change hands now in exchange of now it's an African elite who has no historical background. And also I know the farm my ancestors were forced to work on until they were chased. And I remember taking my great-grandmother when she turned 80. All she wanted was to, could you please take me back to see that farm where we used to live? And we took her there and we begged the white person to let us in to see the cemetery of the people who were buried there. And then she left. 4 years later, she died. Mm-hmm. So we still have these stories in our family.
Jephta Guherimo is head of the Ova Herero People's Memorial and Reconstruction Foundation, speaking with us about recognition of the Namibian genocide.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.